Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of room and window, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Chris Roebling, Democrat Dan Johnson Weinberger, Professor Robert Starks, and talk show host Kenny Rahmeyer of KLBJ in Austin, Texas. Our program tonight coming to you from our new home base at the new Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And we're on the web as well at www.beyondthebeltway.com. Nice to have you with us tonight. I want to talk at the beginning of the program. We will be talking about Republican politics. We'll be talking about the likelihood of Obama re-election, and also the issues that are most likely to either save or sink the president of the United States. We've got some good, verbal combat on tap for you tonight. But I would like to begin with an article that Norman Ornstein, who is with the American Enterprise Institute, he also writes for Roll Call, one of the great political observers in the country. He basically suggested this week that although the economy looks real bad, and Democratic incumbents or any Republican normally doesn't do well when the economy looks that bad, because so many key states are now in control of Republican governors and legislatures, and those legislatures and those governors may have to do some very unpopular things, that maybe that will play to the advantage of the president. Let's ask our Republican, Chris Roebling, whether he sees any wisdom in that assessment from Norm Ornstein.
Norm Ornstein is a brilliant guy, and he's been around forever.
But
like most folks, like most folks in those corridors of power, he's a liberal, and he wants desperately. You know, there is a theme out there about disarray on the Republican side. There's a theme out there about how states are going to have to make tough decisions. The reality is, Barack Obama has had 2 years in office. His prescriptions for the economy have failed miserably. All of his promises have been broken, and he's got a very tough row to hoe. The really important element about the states, I think, what's most important for the states is that Barack Obama, for instance, was at about 55 or 58% approval in Pennsylvania before the 2008 election. Now he's down to 41%. The number of states in which Barack Obama remains competitive, it has reduced very significantly, and the demographics of the people with whom he's competitive has shrunk.
So you totally dismiss the feeling of a voter going into the polls on Election Day next year who may be more upset with their Republican governor and might decide not to reward the Republican candidate
for president.
I think
people, when the national economy is not doing well, as arguably it was not doing well in the fall of 2008 after the crash in September, people think that that is the responsibility somehow, and I think sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. They think that inures to the benefit or the detriment of the president, not the governor.
Dan Johnson Weinberger is our Democrat. What do you think of Ornstein's suggestions, analysis?
I think he's onto something, because I think as Republican as most state governments are cutting back on spending, meaning tuition is going up for higher education, meaning class sizes are going up, meaning there's less health insurance and Medicaid programs, people don't like that. And I think as we come into the election a year and a half from now, and the debate is largely about whether we should continue to cut spending and continue to roll back things like Medicare, which is now the heart of the Republican budget plan, I think voters are starting to see a crystallized debate. And I think they are going to turn against cutting back more government in a time when they want more support for their families.
Bob Starks joins us, political science professor. What do you think, Bob?
I agree. I agree with Johnson totally. These governors and legislatures are shooting themselves in the foot, like the governor of Wisconsin. There's no way that governor and the governor of Ohio and Indiana, which is the heart of really where Obama has got to make a big stand. And that's, by the way, why the Obama campaign is in Chicago, because it's right in the Rust Belt. And this is where he's got to make a stand.
By the way, we should also mention that in many of those key states, the Republican governors who won just at the last election day, they are now looking at approval ratings that are not as sweet as they once were. Let's look at some of the list. Rick Snyder, who is the governor of Michigan, he's at 33% approval. Rick Scott of Florida at 29%. John Kasich of Ohio at 33%. Scott Walker, who the aforementioned member of, you know, person from Wisconsin, he's doing pretty well at 43%. Kerry Branstad of Iowa at 39%. And Chris Christie, his approval rating, he's got 44% of people that love him, 44% of the people who disapprove of his plan. But again, there isn't anything, just to confirm, there isn't anything about these figures that worry you, Chris Roebling.
I think that times are tough out there. I think times are tough, and I think that Barack Obama has had an opportunity. He's been up at the plate, and he's got three strikes, and I think he's going to be out in whatever it is, 16 months.
The key thing is that it's the referendum. Should this be a referendum on Barack Obama? And if it is, Bob Starks, are you happy to make that about that race?
Oh, no, I don't think it should be a referendum on him. I think it should be a referendum on the Republican Party. Republicans run the House. They stifled every progressive bit of legislation that the Obama administration put forward when they were in control of the House and the Senate. I mean, so I think the referendum should be on the Republican Party, not on the president.
But Obama was the change agent. He was going to change.
Yeah,
them.
But you
he
can't
was going to make things better.
In two years.
Why should it not be on him?
Well,
he was the one who said he was going to do certain things, Dan.
I would say this. I think the professor has a point in that elections are about the choice for the next 2 or 4 years. And one of the wonderful things about the Republicans taking over the House and all these Republican governors is now it's clear the consequences of the choice. Mm-hmm. That when you say you want to cut government spending, that means you're going to pay more health insurance. When you say you want to cut government support for education, that means your tuition's going up. And I think, especially with the Medicare proposal, it's going to be a clear choice, which is why, absent the Republicans taking over the House, maybe we'd have a tougher time with a Barack reelection. But it's a clear distinction between the two parties, and I think people are going to lean towards Barack rather than the Republicans.
Well, let me just add one other thing. In the university, I teach in a state university. State universities across this country are cutting back, which means then that young people are not going to be able to go to college. At my university, 85% of the students get some form of state and federal aid. If you cut back on the state aid and the federal government is cutting back,
right,
those students are not going to be able to go to school.
Which side
you have
news.
An angry crowd of young people that are going to not vote for Republicans.
I've got news.
Mm-hmm.
Government is too big, and we cannot afford it. Am I hearing music? Are we leaving?
No, yes. Very good.
Right.
You've heard the music.
I'll finish that
political
point.
That political theme is leaving.
We're really going to hand it to you guys.
You're going
to
finish that point, 1-800-723-8229. Please continue from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Sugarland, Texas to Spokane, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number, and we're going to go to calls in just a moment. But Mr. Dan Johnson Weinberger, I have got to ask you this question.
Yes.
And that is one of the great challenges that the Democrats are dealing with right now.
Yeah.
You're going to have to put a little defense here.
Okay, I'm ready.
Is the great congressman from New York.
Oh, here we go.
Representative
Wiener.
The old Wienermobile. I've just given him the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile.
It's your turn in the barrel, Dan.
This one's
tough. Now, the question is.
Wienermobile.
The question is.
Yes.
Should he resign?
Here's what I think. I don't run the DNC, and I understand why the DNC thinks he should resign, because it's certainly not a good thing for the momentum of the Democratic Party. Having said that, I take the view of my politicians. You're kind of like a plumber, or you're like a service provider or a lawyer. I don't care what you do in your home. I don't care what you do on your BlackBerry. I just want to know what sort of a job you're going to do when you get to the House. So my personal view is, assuming you did nothing illegal, which I think right now looks like a fair assumption. If you did something illegal, that's different. But assuming you didn't do anything illegal, he just did something unquestionable with his marriage, personally, I don't care.
But Dan, let me tell you what he did. He lied. He not only lied about himself, which all, you know, I suppose all politicians do that, but he lied about how this all happened, and he had his minions go out attacking people who were suggesting what actually was the
Breitbart?
Case.
Breitbart? Are you defending and Breitbart?
I'm talking about Wiener right now, because Wiener was out lying.
That's true.
And if you look at I posted on my Facebook I don't have that many Facebook friends. I guess I'm not a friendly guy. But anyway, I saw this tape
You're not
of
setting
CNN.
Out the right pictures.
I saw this. Well, I sent out this CNN exchange that he had with a CNN Capitol Hill reporter and a CNN Capitol Hill producer, where he called the producer a word that cannot be used on radio.
Uh-oh.
This is a guy you ought to abhor. You ought to be. Yeah. I mean, this is a Democratic Party.
Let me ask you a question, though. As a Republican operative, don't you want him to stay? Because every day he stays,
I don't want him to stay because I know the people of Queens. But the people of there's more going on. These are issues of significance.
So you want them to stay?
This is a guy who's obviously got some kind of personal issue, a serious problem. He himself has checked himself into some kind of rehab thing. So I don't know what that's all about. But
I don't know what kind of rehab that is. What is it?
I don't know. I don't want to get into the
photographer or what.
I don't want to get into the salacious
aspect. He may be going
to
the same one that
the people of that district deserve somebody who is not going to be lying constantly about what he's done.
It's a fair point that he lied for me.
Let's ask the professor. What are the students, as a professor, as someone who molds young minds.
That's right.
What do you think?
Well, personally, I think I would have to agree with Dan. He serves his constituents very well. They love him in Queens and in Brooklyn. And he is one of the champions on the floor in the House, one of the progressives that really stands up to the Republican Party.
So we're going to let him stay?
I would say let him stay.
But I should confess, I have been following him on Twitter for, you know, 3-4 months. He's one of the—
Did you get the
I never got one. Never
got one. The offending photo?
But he's actually, I think he's the funniest congressman on Twitter.
And
he's really, I mean, it's really too bad because, you know, he's
let's just say it's an acquired taste at best.
You should, it's funny stuff.
Here, all right, give me the Wienermobile back.
And the Democrats.
You got to get full value out of that Wienermobile. I'm
thoroughly embarrassed by
the total situation. Somebody suggested the other day, they said, let's get a shot of, by the way, for those listening to us on radio, we're also on television in Chicago. And over in your bookshelves, and this is just coincidental, over the bookshelf where the Republican sits, there's a flag.
There is.
That just coincidentally is a flag that's over your shoulder. So the question is, should we put the Wienermobile over the Democrats?
It's a great idea.
We move on.
I appreciate
further notice.
Until he resigns.
Until he resigns.
Let's go to Joe,
Democrat.
Listening to us in Downers Grove, Illinois, on WLS. You're on the air.
Yes, Bruce, regarding this Paul Ryan voucher plan, I'm a 68-year-old senior citizen, and I think Medicare is the greatest program ever instituted by Lyndon Johnson and, prior to him, his failure, Harry Truman. When I had private insurance, I had nothing but problems with my underwriter. I went to an emergency room, and I received a call about a week after I went to the emergency room that I had to contact them first for pre-approval to go to emergency room. I spoke to the woman and said,
"So, what are you going, sir? What are you going to do politically? Just so we don't bring this down to your particular issue, what are you going to do politically next year to either reward or congratulate someone who you think is doing a good job at the polls?"
Well, it's already happening all this state. This Chris Christie in New Jersey is an embarrassment. The man is using a private helicopter to go to his son's baseball game. The Republicans have got plenty of money for the elite, but middle class and lower middle class have to tighten their belts. The Republican Party, in my opinion, will never change.
Right.
Okay. They are for wealthy people.
All right. Well, let me tell you who's defending Medicare.
Right, let's let Chris let's let Chris roll
I missed the caller's name. I understand he's from Naperville, but
Joe Downers Grove.
Joe from Downers Grove. Okay, Mr. Joe from Downers Grove.
Why do they call it Downers Grove? Do you know?
There was a guy named Downer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And he bought some land in a grove.
And his wife was named Donnie Diner.
Come on.
Right, let's go. We digress.
Barack Obama is taking right. $500 billion out of Medicare. Excuse me, Joe. Hold on. We're doing the show in here.
Respond.
Barack Obama is taking $500 million out of Medicare. And I want to tell Joe and all the other Joes out there, there isn't going to, and I'm telling my friends on the panel mm-hmm. here, there isn't going to be any Medicare. I mean, you're talking about the kind of money it takes for all of the social spending. Folks, it's over. And this is the part I don't think that the institutional Democratic Party is really connected with. It is over.
Well, this is
right. Hold on 1 second.
All right, take your time.
We are already Barack Obama and Ben Bernanke have already cut benefits. They've cut the benefits because they've monetized the debt and they've debased the currency. What you guys have to relate to is the fact that your spending program is already retrenching the benefits for the recipients.
Dan.
So the Chinese have said we are defaulting.
This is the big disconnect, which is why the professor and I are so enthusiastic about our reelection campaign, is because the Republican base wants to sell a line to the American people, which is we're broke. We're out of money. And you know what it means? You have to pay more or you're going to get less. But let's not mention that we want to continue to cut taxes on the wealthy who have the money. And let's not mention that we want to continue to perpetuate our massive military-industrial complex and continue the war. So that's why that distinguishing characteristic of Republicans trying to beat the drum that we're broke, people don't want to hear it because they know we can pay to improve our standard
of
living.
Let's go to Bob in Meridian, Idaho, listening to us on KBOI. Go ahead, you're on the air. Bob, are you there? Bob, going once, going twice. Let's go to George on WLS in Chicago. Go ahead.
Yes. Donald Trump did every, and Jerome Corsi for that matter, did everyone, every American a great favor by forcing Obama to produce a so-called long-form birth certificate, which is clearly a fraud. Anybody who goes to WorldNet Daily and types in a birth certificate in video can see a detailed analysis.
Okay, what's your next point?
So the bottom line is if the Republicans can't pick this up, they forgot Ronald Reagan's trust but verify. If they can be so gullible as to not to demand a detailed analysis of that birth certificate right now, right here, right now, then what are they going to do with the Russians or the Chinese or anybody else if they're that gullible?
George of Chicago, we're off that. We're not talking. I mean, nobody cares.
As an independent if the Republicans can't do it.
Okay. George of Chicago. President Obama. Let me make this real clear. President Obama was born in Honolulu, Hawaii in something like 1961. 61. Okay, that's finished. We're not doing that. What we're talking about is the economic future of this country and the ability of this country to provide a future for its kids and its grandkids. And right now, they're already cutting benefits, you guys. That's what QE2 did, and that's what QE1 did.
And thank God for the Affordable Health Care Act that extended the life of Medicare by an additional 3 years.
$500 billion from Medicare.
And we're bending that cost curve.
Bloomington, Illinois, WRPW. Wayne is listening tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello there, sir.
Hello there.
Wayne. Yeah, I'm an over-the-road truck driver.
Good.
Going through Illinois right now. I got a question now. I'm a history buff. I'm 64 years old. Came out of the war in Vietnam in 1970.
Thank you for serving.
And I've been unemployed 2 months since I came out of the war and asked if my boss folded up. But anyway, beside the point, I want to know one professor that's there or whatever said that students ain't going to get an education. Because the government's going to cut off funding.
Right.
I was born and raised in this country where everybody made their own way. What I'm trying to figure out is, where does everybody get this dependency on the government? And at the same time, where does all this money come from?
Bob Starks, let him respond.
Well, sir, if you think back to the post-World War II, all of the men who came out of that war had veterans in benefits that allowed them to go to school, to buy a house on FHA, to do all kinds of training, et cetera, et cetera. These have been benefits that have been in place since that time, and I don't see why they should be cut off. You had benefits that you accrued as a result of being in the Vietnam War. If you do you realize the cost of education today, the college education? Do you realize that?
But I think you were talking about those that did not were not veterans, though.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is if you cut off that amount of money, it would affect the veterans, too, because this government, the Republicans, are talking about cutting back benefits for veterans.
You guys, we have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, there may be a new name in the Republican presidential field. We'll talk a little bit about Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, when we come back from Chicago. From Manchester, New Hampshire to Houston, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our Democrat tonight is Dan Johnson Weinberger. He is a lobbyist for progressive causes. Chris Roebling is also with us. He is a public affairs associate for Jane Thompson and Associates. And Bob Starks also joins us. He is a professor at Northeastern Illinois University for many, many years. And let's go back to calls in just a moment after we spend a little time talking with our friend Kenny Rahmeyer. Kenny, are you with us?
Absolutely, Bruce.
Kenny is a veteran talk show host for KLBJ in Austin, Texas. He is on every weekend. He is on after us every Sunday night. And my question to you, Kenny, because there's been so much discussion of Rick Perry, and we talked a little bit about it a couple of weeks ago, where is that pendulum swinging right now in the state of Texas?
You know, I would say it's definitely gaining momentum, Bruce. Of course, the governor's staff continues to say he's focused on the legislative session that's still underway, and no decisions will be made until after that. However, clearly when Mitch Daniels, the Indiana governor, decided not to run, when Huckabee, former Arkansas governor, decided not to run, even some favorable comments on Rush Limbaugh's program not too long ago, and then Gingrich stumbling badly out of the gate. So this thing has definitely gained some momentum and some traction over the last several weeks.
Now, a question that people around the country who may be casually interested in politics may want to know or may remember is that Rick Perry was challenged for renomination by Caleb Bailey Hutchinson. He won the primary. But it's very odd for a popular Republican governor to be challenged for renomination. What was that all about?
Well, you know, Senator Hutchinson had a great run as a senator. I think personal reasons with some young kids and that, maybe she wanted to get back to her home state. But if you remember, Bruce, the buzz in the media at that time, that primary election was really framed in the media as a lot of people are going to go to school on how well an anti-establishment governor like Rick Perry runs against a very popular senator from Texas, Kay Bailey Hutchinson. But he successfully framed that race, Bruce, as I'm Rick Perry, the outsider, and Kay Bailey is the traditional D.C. politician, and he beat her handily.
As you put him on a list of all of the other Republican contenders at the moment, where would you put him? Where is his you've talked about his anti-Washington, obviously. That's always an appeal in the Republican primary and even in the general election. But where would you put him on the list of the other potential nominees?
Well, he's been running a stealth campaign in that he's been able to kind of lay back, watch all the other churn that's been going on. I put him up close to the top of the list, Bruce, and here's why. I think if you take a look at some of the positives, he's got an incredibly good personal story, everything from, you know, born in a small town in West Texas, Eagle Scout, a Yell leader at Texas A&M. He's a captain in the Air Force, married his childhood sweetheart, and he's definitely got strong economic numbers to point to here in Texas. Over 700,000 jobs in the private sector created on his watch over the last 10 years. as governor.
According to the Wall Street Journal Friday, 37% of the jobs created were created in the state of Texas.
37% of the net new jobs
net
in
new
the
jobs.
United States since, I think, 2001.
Yeah, so an enviable economic record here. Beyond that, he's a polished politician. He knows how to play the game.
Looks good.
This legislative session, he's got some key things to point to there. A voter identification bill. A bill that says doctors have to perform a sonogram before abortions. I mean, if you just take a look at the red meat for the conservatives, he's got a lot of that.
Bob Starks has got a question for you, Kenny.
Surely.
Kenny, how does he justify his move to secede from the United States with running for president?
You don't hear much about that, frankly. That was a pretty good overture to maybe the Tea Party crowd. At one time, something else I want to say too.
Would that come back to haunt him, possibly?
I don't think so. I actually think there's a couple of other things. If he's going to have issues, some of the bigger issues. If the White House is not doing opposition research already, I'll bet they're going to do it soon. I mean, you know, Texas, while it has a good economic record, our record is not so good in terms of percent of the population that don't have health insurance or. I think we rank something like 45th in high school graduations. And I'll tell you, another negative, I think, for the guy is, frankly, just the too soon after Bush factor. I don't think you can overlook that. And for me, a negative is he's a career politician. A guy like Mitt Romney can point to some good economics maybe in his own state or certainly with the businesses that he's ran, and he can point to business experience.
So
Governor Rick
so
Perry is a career politician.
So he's a career politician, but yet he may have mastered the anti-Washington message.
Well, he's definitely, and he's just written a book recently, you know, Fed Up, that was all about how we should do almost the exact opposite of everything that's going on in Washington, D.C.
Sounds good to me. I want to ask you this. What about his views on foreign policy? Where does he come out on foreign issues, and has he had any time running that big state down there to really study those issues beyond the relationship with Mexico, which is very important?
Well, I'll have to say I haven't heard much about anything from a foreign policy standpoint other than the immigration issues here with Mexico, and he's definitely been very vocal about that, a very harsh critic of the Obama administration for lack of resources and lack of focus on the Texas-Mexico border.
But where do you put him, comparing him with Jan Brewer in Arizona? Because as I understand it, you know, those who look at that issue as a you know in a very serious way, you know, they will praise Jan Brewer. They'll be a little less exciting about Rick Perry. Is that true?
Well, he's you know, he was critical of that immigration legislation in Arizona. I would say he would run circles around her just from a pure political savvy standpoint. I don't even put him on the same platform there. I think he's heads and tails above her.
Dan Johnson Weinberger, a Democrat, has a comment.
Is Governor Perry considered the type of governor that works with Democrats, or is he sort of considered the you know, the leader of the pack of the Republicans and kind of rolls over the Democrats in Texas?
Well, interestingly, you know, he started out in the Texas legislature in '84, I think, as a Democrat.
Right?
He has since obviously become a Republican, and I'd say, you know, he is pretty well. In a Republican state, in a red state, he's kind of rammed through the key priorities that he set out for this legislative session, that sonogram bill, the voter ID bill. I gave you those couple examples of some good ones there that he's pretty much had his way in the legislature so far. And a new budget with no tax increases. Okay?
What about, how close is he to the Bush family?
Well, you know, that's interesting because during the primary against Kay Bailey Hutchison, the short answer, Bruce, is not very close. A lot of the key supporters of former President Bush were definitely more on Kay Bailey's side than on Rick Perry's side. And there's really not been a lot of love lost lately between Governor Perry and the Bush family, I would say.
Chris Roebling, that could be a plus then. Go ahead.
That could be a plus. I want to ask you, it's one thing to talk about running for president. It's another thing, as Mitch Daniels learned, to actually do it. Mm-hmm. What is your personal expectation? What are the odds that you see that he will actually enter the race and contest the nomination?
You know, I can't give you more than, I'll say this, it went from 30% he was going to, 60% he was not going to. I'd say that's evened up to at least 50-50 right now. Money is not going to be an issue for him, everything right. that I've read. And he's potentially going to pick up some of these key operatives from the Gingrich staff that right. actually a few of them used to work
right.
for Governor Perry. So, and if you look at his travel schedule, just look at his schedule here over the next few weeks. He was out in L.A. today, in fact, where he was slamming the Obama administration on abortion. It was a big pro-life rally. He's going to be in New York subbing for Donald Trump on Tuesday. Then he goes down to Louisiana for this leadership conference for the Republicans. And then he's in North Carolina, Alabama. I mean, you take a look at the guy's schedule, and he's put a stake in the ground for a big prayer event in Houston later on this summer, which is already drawing some controversy. New York Times this weekend had some people concerned about why is a politician getting involved in religion and that sort of thing. So, but I think there, another key point, he's going to say, President Obama said we're not a Christian nation. Guess what? We're going to have a big Christian prayer event right down here in Texas. So he's going to, again, kind of shove it right back in the president's face.
What do you, again, you're sort of hedging because you're not quite sure where he might go.
Well, it's because, nobody in his inner circle will talk on record. And I'm just giving you snippets of my sense from talking to reporters that are covering this guy.
Actually, I think that's a big plus if he's got people close to him that aren't talking to the press a lot. But my question to you is, What have the callers to your show been saying? We've had a few, obviously, called last week when we brought up the subject because many of our listeners are your listeners and vice versa. But overall, you're taking a lot more calls from Texas than we are. What are they saying to you?
Yeah, and actually, I would say, again, it's 50% in favor of Rick Perry and 50% not. Keep in mind, UT, University of Texas, did a poll recently. He's only got 41% approval rating. In 06, he limped into re-election with 39%. Just in 2010, he got 55% of the vote. This is a huge red state. Those are not big numbers for a Texas governor, per se. So, frankly, he may do better in other parts of the country than here in his home state of Texas. I mean, he'd do enough to carry it, but I'm just saying 39% and 55% are not huge margins.
Kenny Raymeyer, thanks very much for joining us. If you're listening to us on KLBJ, stay right where you are because he's going to be with us every Sunday night right after we go off the air. Always a great report from Texas. Kenny, thank you very much for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Back more with your calls when we roll on from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let us go to calls. I think we have Bob. He was calling from Meridian, Ohio, Idaho, listening to us on KBOI. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. It's good to hear from Idaho. Go ahead.
Well, Bruce, I wanted to pull you back to your first conversation.
That's fine.
The professor said that Republicans had stymied the Democrats, and I think it's a little bit revisionist history to nobody challenges, but the fact is the Democrats had both houses of the Congress and the president, and they couldn't even pass a budget.
You're absolutely right.
They did get a stimulus, $800 billion stimulus passed.
Thank goodness.
A health care, they put in 15 czars. They've had 4 to 8 committees trying to create jobs.
And they saved the car industry in this country.
Yeah, 2 million jobs.
Not really.
No, they didn't save anything.
They saved the car industry in this country.
They subsidized failing companies that would have been taken over by somebody else anyway.
Not GM.
And the American taxpayers wouldn't have been out $2 billion on Chrysler.
Yeah, Bob,
somebody else would have bought it.
You have laid out the bill of particulars.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, respond to what Bob in Idaho has to say.
To Bob
in Chicago.
Well, Bob in Chicago, Bob, the reality is the Republicans did everything they possibly could to undermine the whole stimulus package that was necessitated by a goof-up on the part of the Republican George Bush. Now, you deal with that. Then when he did it, when he did it,
and
he rescued Wall Street.
Whoa. Let's go to Bob in Idaho wants to respond to that. Go ahead, Bob in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
George Bush is no longer in office.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, but
Barack Obama has been in office for 2 years. The Senate Democrats have not even tried to pass one of their budgets in 2 years. They have not even been able to agree among themselves on what they want to pass in the one house of the Congress that they still control.
Yeah, I mean,
but the FIA, yes, you've got
to tell now let's us let, that let's the Republicans, let. The Republicans are stopping the Democrats.
Let's let Dan Johnson Weinberger. This is the tag. We got a tag team here.
That's
go
right.
Ahead.
I'll tag out Bob from Chicago.
Okay,
Dan from Chicago.
Go ahead.
Now we did pass a couple budgets when the Democrats.
You the wiener. I'm going to give you the wiener.
We'll take that wiener again. We're going to give you. Know we gotta face that burden.
Why haven't
we did pass our two budgets when the Democrats controlled it? It is fair to say. That, yeah, hey, absolutely. It's our record for 2 years. And it was glorious. We saved this economy.
Are you kidding?
We saved probably 2.5 million jobs.
Saved jobs at the public level and local and state government.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen. Back to Bob in Idaho. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, if you want to live in a fantasy world,
right.
Which we, as we know, we have $14 trillion of debt.
Yep.
And the debt under the Obama proposed budget will be $23 trillion under his optimistic economic numbers in 10 years. If you believe that is a method to make the American economy and our country a success, you are wrong, and you're going to pull the whole country into places that none of us want to go.
Bob in Chicago, and then we're going to move on.
Bob, do you agree that the budget, the Bush tax cut should be continued? You realize, of course, that we could reap $1 trillion in the next 10 years.
All you have is class warfare. All you have is class warfare.
Bob in Idaho.
Let's let Bob in Idaho respond.
I think we should go with the Pelenty plan.
Pelenty.
Get the actual
Pelenty.
Economic
no,
growth
the next segment.
Yes.
5%.
Right.
The Pelenty plan.
Taxes even more.
The Pelenty plan balances
instead of having a shrinking Obama economy,
right.
Have a growing
right.
Republican economy.
And
well, I like Bob. I think we need more listeners like Bob.
Okay. All right.
And I want to tell
Bob
you,
Starks,
I still haven't heard any explanation for why the Senate Democrats, as Bob points out, and we all know.
That's a simple question.
Have not passed a budget in 2011 and did not pass a budget in 2010. So that when people came back after the election last November, they got back to Washington this spring and they had to pass a continuing resolution because the Democrats, Harry Reid's colleagues, had failed to do their jobs. Why didn't they turn in their salary paycheck? Stifled by the Republicans.
Absolutely.
They were stifled by the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's all their fault.
It's all the Republicans' fault.
Even
when they were in the majority in both houses, they were stifled.
Joe and Schomburg, go ahead. You got about a minute. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. Hi, panel. How you doing?
Okay.
Mr. Roebling thinks that Barack Obama's going to be a one-term president. But Mr. Roebling, who in this joke of a Republican field do you think is going to beat him? Because I'm not the only one that thinks that this Republican field is a joke. There's Republicans that think that this Republican field is a joke.
Let's let him respond.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I think
Mitt Romney, you've got to be kidding.
Let him finish. You've asked a great question now.
It's the
music is running. You've only got 20 seconds to answer.
Well, I don't want to forget anyway. Rick Perry, Sarah Palin, Tim Pawlenty,
there it goes.
Mitt Romney, Michelle Bachmann.
Oh,
I mean,
please.
I want to tell you.
Michelle Bachmann.
I'm telling you.
Hey, can I respond?
I'm going to take any of these
Sarah
folks.
Palin.
I'm going to take any of these folks.
10 seconds.
You guys still don't get it. It's
over.
It's over.
And Paul Revere.
Joe, 10 seconds to you. 10 seconds.
Real clear politics.
No way.
It's over. We'll show that Barack Obama beats all
John Huntsman. I forgot John. I don't mean to forget John Huntsman.
Okay, listen. All right, Sheriff Palin. All right, we got to come back and talk to that.
Yeah, right.
Our thanks to Dan Johnson Weinberg, Bob Starks, Chris Roebling for being with us in hour number one. They're all going to be back in hour number two. And in the next hour, we're going to continue this discussion. All just remember, if we had a real bipartisan ticket, if America really wants a bipartisan ticket, I've got the ticket for you. Wilson Good, the former mayor of Philadelphia, and Tim Pawlenty. Good and Pawlenty. That's what America wants. See you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Chris Roebling, Democrat Dan Johnson Weinberger, and Professor Bob Starks from Northern Illinois University. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And remember, you can join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And speaking of the World Wide Web, we're going to go to calls right off the top of the show because Bob is listening to us on the Internet tonight, calling all the way from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Go ahead.
Hello, Bruce.
Yes.
Bruce, it's Dave from Gloucester.
Dave from Gloucester. I'm sorry. Nice to have you with us.
But I'm a Chicago resident. I'm vacationing here.
Very good.
Last week. I have a question for Dan Johnson Weinberger.
Awesome.
Dan has mentioned in the past that he does not feel that the rich, quote, rich, unquote, pay their fair share.
Go ahead.
I'd like to know what tax break.
We have lost our...
Is that Dave?
Dave, we've lost our ability to hear what you have to say. But the question that I see, at least that was put on the screen here, let me ask the question. And
yeah.
Dave wanted to know, what do you consider a fair share of income taxes to be paid by people?
I think
when is rich rich?
I think Congressman Jan Schakowsky had a phenomenal bill that would say if you have income over $1 million, only the income above $1 million will be taxed at, I think it was 40%. Mm-hmm. If in the income above $20 million will be taxed at something like 43%, and income above $1 billion, and there are people that earn more than $1 billion, that income will be taxed at 50%. And I think that would eliminate the deficit.
It's not going to eliminate the debt.
Eliminate
that is not going to eliminate
the
debt.
Word. Chris, I said the wrong word. Eliminate the deficit.
It's not going to eliminate the deficit.
Yes,
combined with withdrawal from the wars. Yeah.
And so to answer the question,
you mean
that's
including
what I think.
Chris Roebling.
Including the third war, including the Libyan war that Barack Obama came up with on the back of an envelope.
I'm getting out of all of them.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me tell you, what we have in the United States is a disproportionate amount of government revenue coming from a very small percentage of people. And what has happened and what is, I think, very corrosive to our social fabric and our sort of sense of joint responsibility is the fact that, don't hold me to the specific numbers, but we're looking at 40, 45% of the people in the United States of America who pay zero income tax.
Absolutely
untrue. And we are looking at rich. These are
Chris,
people.
Chris, let me just stop you for a second. You acknowledge, which is nice in truth presenting your case tonight. You said 40 to 45%, but you're not quite sure.
I don't know the exact numbers.
And then we had Dan Johnson Weinberger, our Democrat, say those are not true.
Yes, because
what is the correct number? Do you know?
Yes, the correct number is more like 2 or 3% of the people that aren't working. Because what Chris said is They don't pay income tax.
I said federal income tax. Well, I said federal income tax.
You meant. That doesn't include is the federal tax on the income earned on your payroll, Social Security and Medicare, which is taxed on your first dollar paid. And so Republicans are fond of saying, well, that doesn't count when I'm coming with my statistic as to who pays the federal income tax. The Social Security and Medicare payroll tax is a larger burden most taxpayers.
Guys, folks, I'm gonna offer a little timeout here, only because I think we could go on and just end up more shouting, which is not what I'm looking for tonight. As you look at the whole campaign,
mm-hmm.
obviously Barack Obama is not going to get a challenge from the left. You agree with that, Bob?
I agree.
Okay,
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So he's going to be sailing along. Mm-hmm. The Republicans, again, they're fighting this media perception that there's seven dwarfs, right. just as the Democrats fought that before. But in that 1 year, one of the dwarfs ended up being president of the United States, Bill Clinton. So my question to you is, as you look at the issues mm-hmm. and looking at where this race is going to be won or lost, are you real comfortable right now, as we in June of 2011? Are you comfortable and cocky that Barack Obama is going to get reelected?
Not cocky, but comfortable.
Why?
Because the seven dwarfs that you talk about are not going to emerge. They're going to continue fighting each other. They don't have a real platform.
One of those is going to be the Republican nominee.
And there's not a single one that can stand up to a challenge by Mr. Obama.
Perfect. Now, Mr. Roebling, at the end of our last broadcast, or the first hour of this show, if you were listening to us both this week and last week, as well as next week, some of the show will air.
Your head is exploding. I know I'm here now listening to you. Go ahead.
This is a live radio show.
Yes, sir.
If you're not watching this show on the radio, you may be watching it on television. If you are, maybe could be a little bit late now that I've explained it to everybody.
Yeah.
My question is, you said at the end of the show when we were going off the air, people were guffawing because you ticked off every single Republican running, and you said that every single one of them, including Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin,
John Huntsman, Rick Perry,
could beat Barack Obama. Do you absolutely, positively, can you look into our camera for those of you who do have a camera to look into, set to look in? You absolutely say that's true?
Hey, that is true.
Wow.
Barack Obama is going down.
You serious?
That is because he has promised. He has promised time and again. He promised the stimulus. You guys were so proud of the stimulus.
Absolutely.
He said, if we do the stimulus, we're not going to have unemployment over 8%. We're persistent unemployment. Nobody wants high unemployment. No Republican, no Democrat. You guys don't want it. We don't want it. The fact is, we still have it, and you can't blame George Bush. You cannot blame the minority Republican. I know, Bob, you want to, and you have on this program several times, and God bless you for it. You're blaming these minority Republicans like they're the ones who are wearing the capes, unlike Congressman Wiener, who says to the people who are following on Twitter, hey, I was wearing my cape. I was really hitting those Republicans. Here you had minority Republicans in the House, minority Republicans in the Senate. The Democrats still couldn't pass a budget. And when they passed...
No, we did.
They passed
a budget.
They didn't pass a budget with the Democrats in the United States Senate when they were in the majority.
Yes, we
They've
did.
Proven
yes, we did.
Unequal
And Johnson
to
Weinberger,
the task.
Our Democrat. Go ahead.
To Chris's point, when those glorious days of 2009 and 2010, when Democrats were running the entire federal government, we passed the budget.
No, they did
not.
Yeah,
we did. We did.
2010. And, that's why we had a continuing resolution vote in the spring of 2011.
You're right. Thank you. But the first year, we did pass the budget.
First year.
Right.
Congratulations.
Right. The biggest tactical mistake, in my opinion, mm-hmm. that we made is that we didn't roll back the Bush tax cuts immediately.
Agreed.
And
agreed.
Instead, 100%. We pushed it back. And that put us on this defensive posturing.
Appeasing the Republicans.
That was the mistake.
I don't feel real appeased, and not many Republicans do.
Our deficit would be far smaller.
Precisely.
Right.
And appeasement, but I thought that Barack Obama was going to be the guy that got along with everybody.
Well, I think that's one of
I want you to think. I want you to think about that. We also have callers on the line. They're going to introduce two new issues, we're going to find out whether or not they will have any traction when voters go to the polls, and also to find out from everybody listening, coast to coast and watching, whether or not these issues are important to you. Stay tuned. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, 1-800-723-8029. We'll go back to calls in just a moment, but I do want to give, I want to talk to Bob a little bit, because last week on this program we did talk about the surprise showing of Herman Cain, an African-American businessman, in the current Republican primary race. And he is, I think, in third place the last time I looked at a poll. He is ahead of a lot of big names in that field. I think only Sarah Palin and Romney are ahead of him and relatively close within striking distance. And I asked this question last week. What would happen if the Republican primary electorate selected an African-American to be the standard bearer of the party, or the standard bearer of the party selected Herman Cain as a running mate? What would it do to the politics in America? Would it give, in your view, and again, we should say you are a very progressive African-American professor, but lay it out truthfully for us. What do you think it would do, at any, if anything, to the political dynamic in the country if a high-visibility, highly articulate African-American ended up on a Republican ticket?
I think Obama would still win, because I think the appeal of Mr. Cain is basically to the far-right wing of the Republican Party. And I think the Republicans might be tempted to put him on the ticket as a vice presidential candidate, thinking that he could attract some African-Americans, just as they put the other guy on as the chairman of the Republican Party, thinking that that would bring some African-Americans over. And obviously, it did not work. I think Mr. Cain is articulate. He's a good businessman, obviously. But I don't think his appeal to the African-American community would be in any way salient.
If there's anyone who's listening who's African-American who would like to rebut what you just heard, 1-800-723-8029.
I mean, here's
Dan,
a guy who said,
yeah,
let me just point this out. Here's a guy who said that welfare was worse than slavery. I mean, how outlandish can you get?
You know, it reminded me, when the professor mentioned it, of McCain, what we understand McCain's thinking was in picking then-Governor Palin to appeal to the Hillary female voters. And it's it'd be interesting if that is whoever the nominee ends up being would do something similar, because, you know, I think that's probably widely appreciated as the most disastrous decision of the entire presidential campaign, which, you know, because at the time McCain was ahead of Barack.
No. The most disastrous decision had nothing to do with Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin was one of the best decisions. Disastrous decision was for John, and I've said this on the program before, was when John McCain announced that he was suspending his campaign relative to the economic crisis, and he had not spoken to Boehner, and he didn't have his ducks lined up relative to the policies necessary to address the crisis. So he said, I'm suspending the campaign. I'm going to go back to Washington. We're going to have a meeting in the West Wing of the White House with the president. Barack Obama is going to be there. We're going to figure out what to do. And McCain ended up on this side of the issue, and John Boehner and the House Republicans were on that side. That was the point at which McCain was moving up. He was surpassing Obama in the early weeks of September. And when he made that decision, he lost it. He failed the test of presidential leadership. Obama, on the other hand, looked very presidential at that time and played that crisis perfectly.
Chris, you're absolutely right. And again, I will recall that when we were at the Republican convention, and we were at the convention, Chris Roebling, you were sitting in on this program on the night that the announcement was made with Sarah Palin. And I will tell you, having been at the convention, she saved that convention.
Oh.
That convention was absolutely hurricane. It wasn't Katrina.
I think it was another
horrendous hurricane that affected the United States. In fact, they shut down the Monday night, but that convention was going nowhere until Sarah Palin.
And I was there for her speech, and I want to tell you.
And she was terrific.
That speech was the most exciting event at a Republican convention since Reagan addressed the party in Detroit in 1980.
That is correct.
Isn't that a perfect example of the disconnect between the Republican base and the swing voter? Because I think Sarah Palin's appeal to a swing voter is very low. And I will say this. I acknowledge she's electrifying for the Republican base. I acknowledge, say the
part
convention.
Part of the Republican base.
Yeah, part of it, right? But
the
knock on, you know, just seriousness of purpose, the idea that she would have the nuclear codes, I think that was just toxic.
But the politics, as you know, because you've been involved in campaigns, the first thing in politics is you've got to secure the base. That decision and what she was able to do in that speech in Minneapolis is one of the three or four defining moments in the history of the Republican Party in the last 40 years.
It truly is. It truly
is. I was there.
I
saw it. I experienced it.
I saw it, and it went to the rafters.
Now, again, after that, there certainly were slips, there were falls, there were stumbles. But I think that I think the race ended up being close because of Sarah Palin, not in spite of Sarah Palin.
She was not prepared at all to go from 0 to 60 in a national campaign. There's no question about that. But I do want to say this. We've got the radio program on tonight, and some of the TV will be next week. But in the recent past, 25,000 of her emails. And already by the time we're doing this conversation, there are people in the Washington Post, there are people in the Times of London, there are people in the Independent of London. So we're getting out of partisan politics in the United States, who are saying that the emails reveal a very diligent, very detail-oriented, very nonpartisan office holder who mastered the considerable issues. I lived in Alaska, and I know what she did to overcome the old boy group that was linked up to the oil group up there. And that's what she faced. And all of that was wiped away by Katie Couric and her own stumbles, her own goals. I mean, she fumbled. There's no question about it. But I think that Sarah Palin is a considerable force. I'm not saying that she's my choice for president, but I think that there is great strength in the wide diversity of the Republican field.
Andrew Sullivan thinks that she can win.
I find it fascinating that, from my perspective, that was the greatest moment after it became clear that she didn't pass the smell test to be in the Oval Office, right? And sort of like crazy Uncle John, right, trying to be hip, picked Sarah Palin, right? So my perception is like, boy, that was phenomenal. I'm so glad that happened. Big time operatives, you guys think that.
But the option at that time, if you will recall who the options were, the only other option at that point that was viable was Tim Pawlenty. And people are saying now that this is a guy that, you know, that is more, is you can watch paint dry and be more exciting. So why would he have given any bump to anybody at that point? Listen, by the way, let us take some calls and see where we are. Let's go to Michael, listening to us in Chicago on WLS.
Yeah, my question is very pointed towards your black progressive. Okay, you're liberal there.
Yeah.
My question to you is simple. Why is it that blacks are only allowed to vote for Democrats and always have to carry the Democrat torch? Why is it that blacks have been held down by white liberal policies, okay, for over 40 years, and has done nothing but decimate and destroy the black family? Why is that?
Yeah.
Why is that when a black man like Herman Cain stands up, okay, he's a very successful man, he don't care if he's black or white, he stands up, the first thing you start doing, okay, is throwing daggers at him. Why is that? Is it because people like you and Jesse Jackson Jr. need the vote? You have to keep your electorate down? Is that why it is? You're keeping the black people on the plantation, the liberal plantation? My God, son.
All right, sir.
Let's let Bob Starks respond. Bob.
Listen, sir. African-Americans voted for Chris Roblin's hero, Jim Thompson, each time he ran. African-Americans have voted for Republicans continuously. So that's not the issue. The issue is Herman Cain is to the right of Attila the Hun.
He is
and
not. Come I, first
on,
of all, now, who knows where Attila the Hun really was on
right.
the spectrum?
So, I mean, come on. So why would you?
Why are you throwing
so
Attila in?
Not, but no, specifically, in what areas? Be specific.
I mean, and he's against Medicare. He wants.
He's not against Medicare. He wants Medicare to survive.
Come on.
You guys, I mean, $500 billion comes out of Medicare under Obama, and you think.
Let him finish.
He's against, abortions. I mean, you know, he goes the whole length.
Jesse Jackson came into politics diametrically opposed to any abortions.
Aren't most black ministers in America
opposed?
They're all against
Christian.
Then why is that an out of mainstream position to have if you're an African American?
No, I'm not saying.
That was one of his examples.
Yeah, but as an elected official, he's going against the Supreme Court. Decision.
I want to ask you this. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, he's not an elected official, but right. I want to ask you this. I really believe that we need less government and more family. I'm not saying kind of family. I'm not one of these Donna Reed or, you know, Leave It to Beaver family or whatever.
Wrong with those people.
Nothing wrong with those people. I'm just saying more family, less government. And the caller raised the question of the cumulative effect.
Since you look like Opie. Has anybody ever told you look like Ron Howard? You could be Ron Howard's
I think look-alike. Ron Howard has hair. Anyway, I got to ask you something. The cumulative effect of all of these social programs in so many parts of the African-American community appears to have been detrimental to the African. I'm not the first person to say it. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was writing about this
Tenure
in the 60s.
Patrick Moynihan.
Any number of African-American scholars and academics.
Have said
okay.
That.
Yeah. So what
anyway,
do we say?
Michael from Chicago has made his mark, and we are going to move on. 1-800-723-8029. Another half hour of calls. We've got a lot of people standing by from coast to coast, from border to border. And we'll also hear about those two new issues that a couple of people would like to bring into our discussion. I'm Bruce Dumont from Coast to Coast and Border to Border. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Wasilla, Alaska to Birmingham, Alabama, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Dan Johnson Weinberger, he is our card-carrying liberal, and he is an attorney. He's a progressive lobbyist. And also a new credential this evening.
That's right.
He is a partner in the law firm of Cotter, Corey, Heather, and Richardson. And also, I don't think we announced the last time you're on the show.
Thank you.
You are a father-to-be.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Late October.
Congratulations.
Thank
Soon
you.
You'll be a Republican.
Chris Roebling is also joining us. He
wouldn't
is
count
in
on
the
it.
public affairs business. Once upon a time, he was the executive director of the Cook County Republican Party and a longtime operative in the state of Illinois, and also with Jane C. Thompson and Associates. That's a public affairs firm. And Bob Starks joins us. He is the longtime professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University.
He's also
the political editor of Indigo Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob in Chicago is listening to us on WLS Radio. And let's go to him because he wants to bring up perhaps a new issue that might get some traction in the presidential race. Go ahead, Bob.
Thanks, Bruce. Listen, I would like to know why we can't pass a law where we have every manufacturer in the United States produce everything here. In other words, make it a law, pass a law where we cannot do business in China or Mexico. Just like with the tobacco issue. If you wanted to buy tobacco from Cuba, our government could indict you for trying to get tobacco from Cuba. Why can't we pass a law and get somebody to put a stop to all this trade overseas, all these manufacturers doing business overseas?
Let's let our Republican, Chris Roebling, tackle that. I'm going to let everybody tackle it, but I'm going to let you tackle it first.
Well, number one, because that is a way to beggar ourselves. That is a way to diminish our productive capability. The only way. Excuse me. Hold on, sir.
We need to go back to work. And all you politicians, the Democrats and the Republicans, you are responsible for this mess. That's because of all the jobs that are overseas. Put a stop to it.
All right. Let's let Chris finish his point, then we're going to go back to you. Chris.
Well, Bob represents a strain of thinking which took hold in the 1930s in very difficult economic times with something called the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which effectively cut off trade. And in the depressed 1930s, they made the tariffs of Smoot-Hawley worsened our depression in the United States and spread the depression around the globe so that it was that much harder to end the depression, and it led to it accelerated the pace to World War II. So what Bob is talking about is protectionism, and protectionism hurts us. Now, Bob right, might now, not want to hear that, but that's the way it is.
Bob on the call, go ahead.
I don't believe that. I believe you could put all these Americans, or most of them, back to work by putting the kibosh on all these manufacturers that do business overseas.
But
put
here's
the Americans back to work here. Why is it we can't buy tobacco from Cuba?
Bob, the reason this doesn't work economically is something called comparative advantage.
Why didn't it work in the 50s and then the beginning of the 60s?
Did it work then, in your view?
No, it has never worked. It didn't work with the Phoenicians and the Egyptians, and it's not going to work now.
Bob Starks has a comment.
I don't believe what you're saying.
Bob, you're going against the trend of globalization.
Bob, listen
to what I'm saying.
Listen.
Globalization has taken over the world trade system, and what we're globalized to the point where you cannot buy a car in this country that has manufactured parts that are all manufactured in this country. So I think what we really need is something in between. Listen, the New World Order, what you need is something in between. Now, President Obama is now sitting down with the manufacturing sector of this country and asking them to bring more jobs back to this country and do more manufacturing, because that is, you're right, we need more jobs for people
Dan Johnson Weinberg has got a comment, then we're going to move on.
Bob, I think you'll be glad to hear what I have to say. That, I happen to lobby for the High Speed Rail Association, so I'm pretty familiar with the, provisions of federal law. And there is a provision of the Economic Recovery Act, or the American Recovery Act, otherwise known as the stimulus, which is called the Buy America provision. Mm-hmm. And much of what we procure for passenger rail cars has a Buy America provision, because this is part of the strategy to build up the manufacturing sector.
And President Obama is pushing that.
But that's right.
Edward in Chicago, you're next. This is another new issue that you want to ask whether or not it will get much traction next year. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's the embalming in Libya, and we're going to be pulling out of Afghanistan slowly, but I think that's going to be coming up. And then we're also doing operations in Yemen. And I think really those troops should be over here guarding the borders, not over there.
Well,
a lot of money being thrown around.
I would agree with you 100%. Let's get out of Libya, get out of Afghanistan, and get out of Iraq.
But this is the president who says he was against war, and he's acting like George Bush.
I think he adopted the George Bush policy.
Why?
And I disagree. I don't know why. I think
could it be? Could it be? Here's just a concept here. Mm-hmm. Could it be that when you're running for president, you can really say anything you want?
True.
And when you become president, you have access to a whole different, you got a whole new set of information that's put before you. And a thinking person, be they a Republican, Democrat, liberal, or conservative, when it comes to issues of national security, they can look at all the same documents and they'll all come to the same conclusion.
Well,
there's certain things we just must do that you can't really say in a campaign, because you know why? You don't really know.
But
the people who are running for president, they don't know as much as the person who is the president.
But, Bruce, remember, if you read the Bob Woodward book, he surrounded himself with people who came out of the Bush administration, and they were Republicans, and they were hawks. They ascribed to the neocon philosophy.
And
according to the book written by Bob Woodward, he was influenced too much by that whole crowd.
So what you're saying is that what you're saying is the great Barack Obama is too weak
to understand the bias of the people around him.
You're saying he was duped?
He was duped by these evil Republicans. You got the minority. I wish I had this power.
He was brainwashed.
Bob is giving me the power.
Obama
I just don't feel it.
I would say this. President Obama didn't say
this. This is
I don't think President Obama didn't say he was against all wars. He said he was against dumb wars. Right. And he thought that the invasion of Iraq was
for
a
Afghanistan.
Dumb
war.
He was for Afghanistan. Now right he's war. Got a new one.
Now, here's
in Libya.
The hard part. This is the hard part.
Right war at the right time.
This is the hard part. I don't know the answer. I don't know what you do with when you want a democratic Arab world and you want to support the Arab Spring. And yes. It could be a wonderful thing. I don't know what you do when dictatorships, you want them to fall. And when dictators let me finish my point. When there is a clear and present danger of a civilian massacre, as I believe there was in Libya, I think it makes sense to say, well, let's try and stop that from happening. It has shifted to regime change in Libya. And I think the global consensus is growing that we want regime change in Libya. But it is a slippery slope between saying we'd like regime change from all these despot dictators that we used to be supporting with our, you know, money towards we're now going to spend our money and our soldiers into creating regime change. And it's a slippery slope that makes me very uncomfortable.
But to me, the bottom line here is, and again, I don't care whether we're talking about Barack Obama in, when he's running for president,
right,
or George Bush when he was running for president, because he said we're not going to do nation building.
All
right.
But then 9/11 came along. 9/11 changed everything. But the reality is, day in, day out, every 4 years, whoever is running for president, I don't care what their political philosophy is, when a challenger is talking about what they're going to do as president, most of them do not have a full set of information before them.
They can't.
So they're making it up.
You're right.
They are making it up.
Wait a minute. Wait. I want to say this. Barack Obama absolutely should have known that what he was saying about Guantanamo was fatuous nonsense.
How could you say that?
You
cannot.
How
can you say that?
Because he is as smart as you say he is.
He is
so therefore
smart.
He knew when he was saying, we're going to close down Guantanamo, he knew that was fatuous nonsense, but he kept saying it.
Why would you say that, Chris?
Because, no, it's not.
Why would you say that, Chris?
Let him make this point.
Why would you say that he knew he could not close down?
He knows things now about Guantanamo that he didn't know then. Then what you're saying is he was irresponsible then. So
no,
you tell me which one. He was irresponsible when he was talking about it then.
No.
So Brad Johnson Weinberger.
So Bruce makes a reasonable point.
Thank you.
Which is that any president has access to classified information, which a candidate does not. That is reasonable on its face. That reasonable point, Chris then twists into some sort of an attack on Barack Obama.
And absolutely.
Dumb,
right?
And
because I know. No, my statement is that Barack Obama is smart. And therefore, he is now doing the smart thing. He's now doing the appropriate thing, which means that he was either being irresponsible or he knew he was doing fatuous nonsense back then.
And we've all been told how smart he is.
He's clearly he's clearly.
Look, the reality is, if I can
smart.
Say this,
my teacher.
You guys got
he is,
to say
he
this.
Is,
he's your teacher.
He's my
he gave
teacher.
You a good grade.
He's
and
exceptionally
he was smart.
He was my friend.
And he's your friend.
He's your friend.
And he used to be a guest on this show, but we'll never see him again.
Are you going to see him again?
Never see him again.
I
predict he will never be back on the show.
How about at the party?
One point. May I please make a point?
We should invite him to the
party. No, you cannot make your point because we're... Can't you hear that music? The music is playing back shortly. We've got one more segment... And then we're going to bring out the booze. From Minneapolis, Minnesota to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's go to Austin, Texas, where Rodney is listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead. Are you there?
Come on, Texas.
Go ahead. Are you there?
Yes, Bruce.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
It's amazing how the media claim that Herman Cain is not qualified for the office because of lack of foreign policy experience. But he made the exact same statement you made on your show just now about a candidate can say anything he wants to, but once he gets into office, he has a lot more information to make an informed decision. When he made that statement that he will not tell people what he would do about the war, it's because he doesn't have enough information. The people on the left said he was not experienced and not a serious candidate. Why is it that you can say that and everyone takes you serious, but he cannot say that?
Well, I don't.
Everyone thinks he's not qualified.
I don't
that
know.
That doesn't make sense to me.
I don't know whether everybody takes me seriously, but the point is, it seems to me that's an obvious fact. If you're running for office, you're not going to have as much information as you would if you were sitting in the White House. And again, you know what happens in a campaign, you deal with a lot of what ifs. You really deal with a lot of what ifs. And I think as America, you know, especially when it comes to foreign policy, you have to believe whether, you know, how someone's mind works. I mean, one of the things, in fact, I think it's one of the strongest things that Barack Obama will have going for him in the area of foreign affairs is all they have to do is to play back his own response when asked what he would do about getting Osama bin Laden.
Right.
He said if it was shown to him there was actionable intelligence
right.
in Pakistan where they could go in and get Osama bin Laden,
mm-hmm.
he would do it. I mean,
and
that's exactly
what
he did.
Without Pakistan's approval.
And without their approval. And, right. and by the way, that you will recall, Hillary Clinton criticized him during the campaign, saying that was a very naive thing to say because, mm-hmm. you know, you can't say that because it was going to disrupt relations
and
with
so
Pakistan.
Did John McCain.
And so did John McCain.
That's right.
But the reality is, to me, that's the clip. That's the singular, you know, when they talk about all the promises that he made that he may have broken, and there are several of those, the one I've just stated is the one that I think you're going to see over and over again.
And as a Republican on the panel, I will say my hat is off to him. I have congratulated, you know, I mean, not that he cares, but the problem there.
That will mean a lot to him.
Yeah, yes.
He knows you,
Chris. The tape of this show.
The problem is what the staff then did. The staff then walked all over that and made it into a hash.
Let's go to Youngstown, Ohio, where Jeff is listening to us on WKBN, the radio home of Dan Rivers. Go ahead.
That's right. How you doing, Bruce?
Okay.
I wanted to say, first of all, the progressive guy that's there is doing the black community a great disservice when he tries to act as though Herman Cain, who is a businessman, grew a business, hiring people, putting things together to make money, is wrong because he has some conservative views, but you can have Barack Obama, whose policies for EPA are keeping our gas prices higher, whose policies are keeping businesses from hiring people. It is absolutely ludicrous, and you have these people believing in you and in your way when your way is not going to do anything but hold everybody down and up first, because in this country, we're still the last hired, first fired. So, I really have a problem with black progressives, per se. That is an oxymoron. I mean, it's ridiculous.
All right, let's let him respond.
Well, sir, let me just say very honestly, I've never said that Mr. Cain was unqualified. I think he's a very smart man. He's a very smart man. I think he's qualified to be president. But his views are the opposite of most of the African-American voters who will go
because
to the polls
like
in 2012. Not because of people like me, but because of the fact that he's against welfare. He's against Medicare. I mean, he's against most
he's
of the...
He's not against Medicare.
What is he saying?
He's like he wants to transform it into a voucher program.
A voucher Let me tell you something. Paul Ryan took a great idea that came from a Bill Clinton commission and put legs on it. This isn't some kind of – you guys are acting like Medicare can be a tool to divide the country. And
no,
the people are moving
like
beyond
a,
you. The people. No. Let me tell you, Barack Obama taking $500 billion out of Medicare has left Medicare hobbled. And what you're seeing out of Herman Cain or Paul Ryan is an attempt to maintain support for the elderly who need health care.
Herman Cain also wants to maintain the Bush tax cuts.
The Bush tax cuts. A lot of people do.
The Bush tax
cuts.
Not
a lot
in my community. African Americans don't
want it. The Bush tax cut extension was supported by Barack Obama in December of 2010.
That's going
to
be.
Sam in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, you're next. Thanks for listening to us on WRNN. Go ahead.
Yes, I think the Republican candidate, whoever that is, will get support like we haven't seen since Ronald Reagan in 1984. I think the Republicans will rally around whoever they do choose, and I think Barack Obama it's going to be a referendum about
who's
him.
Who is your favorite in the field right now? Obviously, by the way, you're very important because I will tell you it is the Republican primary voter in South Carolina that sends, you know, really, I think, most significant signal next year. Who are you for right now, sir?
Right now, I really don't have a favorite. It could be. It doesn't matter. Anybody but
Michelle Bachmann.
No, you got to pick.
Governor, your governor, sir, might be the next vice
Make
president.
Make him pick. You've got to pick.
The United States.
I doubt that.
Nikki Haley.
I don't think Nikki Haley's been on the stage long enough to be the next
Then who do you pick? If you have to pick, gun to your head, you're a Republican, South Carolina primary voter, you got to pick. Who do you pick?
You don't put a gun to your head.
It might be a war of attrition, and Pawlenty might be the last guy standing.
Okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't put a gun to your head.
I hope it's Pawlenty.
They'll shoot you back.
I hope it's Pawlenty because he's the dullest of them all.
Okay, well, just remember, not if he's running with Wilson Good because America's ready for Good and Pawlenty.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Dan Johnson, Weinberger, Bob Starks, Chris Roebling have all joined us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with You Know Who, WLS Radio in Chicago. Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman make this program possible. Until next week at the same time, this is First Two Mike. Good night from Chicago.